A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 19, 1997, entitled Beyond Reason, Discovery in Worship and Mission. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 7, and John 1, verses 1 through 9. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
Well, this is a great experience for us. It's a Sunday designated by a large part of the church as Christian Unity Sunday. It's a time in which we acknowledge that which is not true, but that which ought to be true. We acknowledge that we know better than we do. And over the past 25 years of my second term here in this congregation, one of the great experiences for me has been the warm friendship between our neighboring parishes, St. Mary's and Christ Community. We have sung Christmas carols together. We have joined together in ecumenical services. The choirs have made presentations as this morning. We've had good fellowship together in our fellowship hall with hot chocolate and good things to eat. It's been one of the enriching experiences to me to experience the unity and the community between these two parishes. And I know from many of you, I've heard the same thing. And I've heard it also from the people of St. Mary's when we've had these occasions. Because prior to that, we lived in the community together. Perhaps we were neighbors, maybe we worked together. But on Sunday morning, there was this kind of iron curtain that divided us. And no one gave us permission to embrace one another as brothers and sisters in the faith. And so it has been a beautiful experience for two neighboring parishes, one Roman Catholic, one Protestant, to recognize that the things that divide us are superficial, and the things that make us one are fundamental. And this morning, this is another wonderful experience of that unity that we have in Jesus Christ. And God knows that unity is imperative for our world. The Roman Catholic theologian from whom I have learned so much, Hans Kuhn, has said that there will be no peace among the nations until there is peace among the religions, and there will be no peace among the religions until there is peace among the churches. That says it succinctly, and it says it pointedly, and it is true. Wherever you look in the globe today, wherever there is trouble, potential violence, living perhaps on the edge of war, you'll find at the root of the conflict religious fervor or someone using religion to fuel the fires of discord and alienation. It is imperative that as people of faith, we learn to live together. And in order to live together, it is imperative that we come to experience that oneness that is ours because we are all the children of the one eternal God who in the beginning brought all things into being and created humankind in God's image with a heart that continues to yearn to embrace all God's children. I believe that's a biblical truth. The passage from Isaiah is a very familiar passage. It's one of the servant songs in that section of Isaiah 40 to 55, a servant poem in which, to begin with, the servant seems to be Israel itself and then moves to an individual who calls Israel to come to itself and to realize its purpose. Because the song indicates that Israel was to be the place in which God was glorified on earth. God chose this people, and in this people God would show God's glory. And so the servant is to call Jacob back to God, to call Jacob back to that prior claim to be that place where the light of God would dwell on earth. God chose Israel, not to the exclusion of the nations, but in order to bring light to the nations. And in this poem, after the servant hears the call to bring Jacob back to God, then the voice says, "But that's not enough. That's too light a task. I will make you a light to the nations, in order that my salvation may be known to the end of the earth." I believe that Israel at its best, at its moments of most profound understanding, saw itself to be the light of God, to share with the nations in order that the world might experience God's saving grace. We in the Christian church believe that light came to sharp focus in Jesus. In the prologue to his gospel, John writes of the Word that in the 14th verse becomes flesh. But in the meantime, that Word speaks of the God who is the source of life and light for the world. And he points to John the Baptist, and he says, "John was not the light, but John came to bear witness to the light, that light that enlightens everyone was coming into the world." Christmas was the coming in human flesh of that one who would say, "I am the light of the world." Jesus was not in himself the source of light. Jesus was not the exclusive light given to humankind. Jesus was the human flesh, was that supreme moment when the light that flows from God, that enlightens everyone, was coming into sharp focus. Jesus became the locus of the light, the light of God that enlightens all. I believe that is biblically true. But if it's true, how can we realize it? How can we make it concrete in our world? Well, I've seen the title of this sermon printed in the press and in the bulletin and a couple of other places, and it never appears the same way twice. And it never appears once correctly. Now, this probably goes back to me. I'll claim that. But what I want to say to you this morning is that beyond reason, the truth is discovered in worship and mission. I say beyond reason. I say that because we will never come to the experience and the realization of unity through rational discussion. Now, I should say that, huh? I'm the incurable theologian. I am always thinking, thinking, thinking. And I think when I write with great persuasion, when I speak with the tongues of angels, I think the whole world will see it. I can't figure out why everybody doesn't see it. But alas, I learn to my despair, well-reasoned argument doesn't do it. It must be beyond reason It must be experienced. When it is experienced, it need not be discussed, debated, or argued. When it is experienced, it is known. It becomes a reality. And it is my claim this morning that the experience comes not as I wish it would come, by some finely fashioned sermon, some theological discussion, some erudite essay. No, it will come when it comes in worship and in mission. It will come when Glory in Excelsis Deo is sung magnificently by human voice accompanied by instrument. It will come when we as a people are lifted into the presence of the living God, when we are lifted out of ourselves and there is that transcendent moment when we know ourselves caught up in wonder, love, and praise. It is in worship, those moments of adoration, those experiences when we lose our head, when we open our heart, when our whole being pulsates, when our goosebumps have goosebumps, and then we know, beyond any argument, when we see two choirs gathered together from two parishes, from two great traditions, singing one voice to the glory of the one God. Don't we know in that moment that we are together the children of God who delights in the worship of that combined chorus? It is in worship, whether in corporate worship like this or in other moments when in different gatherings we may suddenly experience ourselves together. You know that Saturday nights are sacred. I seldom venture out of the house, but we did last evening for a special occasion, the birthday of the husband of the co-chair of the Jewish Christian Dialogue Committee, my co-chairman, Sylvia Kaufman's husband. One of those decade-turning birthdays, a very festive evening, a wonderful party. And because Sylvia and Dick Kaufman are Jewish, there were Jewish friends and relatives, but because they have been in that community so long, there were Gentiles as well, and people of all stripes. And because Sylvia is chair of the Jewish Christian Committee, there were members of the committee. There happened to be four clergy persons there. And in spite of that, it wasn't a bad evening. And Sylvia, I think, on an impulse, said, how about our resident clergy blessing the meal before we partake? And so we did. A Presbyterian. What am I? A Lutheran and a Jewish rabbi. And for a moment, that assembly there gathered knew a transcendence that deepened the evening. And we knew that we were one before the true God who gives us bread. It is in worship that the superficial things that divide us are dissolved, and we know ourselves truly to be one. And it is in mission. It is when we are not thinking the faith, but doing the faith. It is when our parlor on Thanksgiving is filled with the aroma of roast turkey, and there are people from various parishes around the community who gather together, roll up their sleeves, serve those who need a place on Thanksgiving, wash the dishes, generally make this a place of hospitality. And it doesn't really matter what your brand is. Together, there is a serving community of the people of Christ, serving as an expression concretely of the compassion of God for all of those who would come. It comes in mission. This is the birthday of Martin Luther King. It was 29 years ago that he was cut down by an assassin's bullet. He was a prophet in our midst. We liked him not a little, not a lot. He did not, of course, receive the honor in his life, which is typical for prophets. But he had a dream. And in the rich cadences of that black preacher, this nation was sensitized. And we recognized the horror of that racism that was encased in law. And his dream caught on, and black and white together began to make those moves to dismantle that structured racism, which is still far from where it ought to be, but which has been moved immeasurably by one man who had a dream of the day when people would be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the character of their soul. And the dream was caught by black and white and young and old, and the landscape was changed. And we came together because we were doing what was right. And when we were doing what was right, then we knew that there was a deeper unity that bound us together, that we were all the children of God. It is in worship and it is in mission that we come to experience that genuine unity of the human family. I got a call 3 or 4 weeks ago from a man named David or Daniel Fox. I had gotten a note to call this person. I didn't know who he was. There were some notes scribbled about what he wanted, but it didn't make any sense to me. And I have returned a few calls in the last few months that I wish I hadn't. And so I wasn't too eager to dial up this number, but I did. And I found out that this was a gentleman who was a nephew of a chaplain in the Second World War, who had been one of the 4 chaplains who had gone down with a troop ship. Those of you who are older, like I am, will remember the story, perhaps. It was the nephew of one of those chaplains who was trying to gather data and knew that I was a minister in the Reformed Church of America at one time and thought I might be able to give him some information about one of the chaplains whose name was Clark Poling, who was a minister in the RCA. So I pointed him to the archives of the RCA, but we chatted a bit about the story. I did remember the story, and I did remember that one of them, Clark Poling, was of the Reformed Church. But he reminded me that it was early in the Second World War, the USS Dorchester was torpedoed in the North Atlantic by a Nazi torpedo. And they had not enough life jackets on board. And there were 4 chaplains on board. And those 4 chaplains took off their life preservers. And they handed them to the troops. And then, as the troops were scrambling overside and into lifeboats, The chaplain stood on deck, and they prayed for the troops, for their survival and their safety. And the ship was mortally wounded, and as it was slipping into that watery grave, the four chaplains stood on deck, linked arm in arm, praying for their people. One was a Methodist. One was a pastor in the Reformed Church. One was a Catholic priest. And one was a Jewish rabbi. What a picture. What an image. As they slipped under those icy waters and came into the presence of light eternal, do you suspect it mattered one whit that one was Jewish, one was Catholic, and two were Protestant? Of course it didn't. You know it didn't. And the reason you know, I know you know it didn't, is that about 5 years ago I had an epiphany experience in this congregation. I was on my way to Brandeis University to a think tank on congregational affiliation for Catholics, Protestants, and Jews. Do you remember? It happened to be Reformation Sunday. And I told you where I was going and for what reason, and I suggested that perhaps I should go to Brandeis and say to that group, what we really need to do, we who are from Geneva, we should go to Rome and pick up our brothers and sisters there and go to Constantinople, picking up more brothers and sisters, moving to Mecca, and then to Jerusalem, where we might all experience the truth that we are all together the children of God. And you know what you did before you were in the habit of doing it? It had never happened before. For the first time in my ministry, you applauded the sermon. And you said to me, we've known it all along. When will you catch up with us? You, the people, knew it. When I articulated it, you affirmed it. Because you knew it. You knew it here. And my confidence for the future lies in the fact that you know it. And increasingly, the people of God, of whatever stripe, will be saying to ecclesiastical leaders, church bureaucrats and bishops and all kinds of such animals, you will be saying, get out of the way. Because we are coming together. Because in your heart, you know it's true. Now, Mr. Bryson, is it possible to repeat that opening chorus in order that we might move from the ridiculous back to the sublime? And experience that glory of God which is common to us all.